Did you know you can listen to CIUT 5 different ways? Online, on satellite TV, digital cable, on FM radio, and on the go. Find CIUT online at iTunes Radio under Campus University, or go to the live stream at www.ciut.fm. You can also locate us on satellite at Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, and Bell 5 Channel 970. Listen to us on the go with TuneIn Radio's free app. And don't forget, we're on the FM dial at 89.5 FM. Spread the word. The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5 FM.
Who want everybody come on the floor?
It's the Vibe Collective.
What's good?
Wow. So we focus on things like hip-hop, environmental justice.
Social justice.
Social injustice.
Love. Resistance.
Oh, wow.
Art, you gotta music. Throw in love.
Oppression awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And?
Oh, celebrity gossip, of course.
And let's roundtable introduction of our collective.
What's good? I'm Luam.
Victoria Grant, a.k.a. Victoria Grant.
Adrian Worrell, a.k.a. DJ Griffin.
Kemba King and Melinda Malley, a.k.a. Docu Vixen, and Jemias are on assignment today. And I'm going to throw it to Luam to introduce our awesome guest.
So today, we have somebody named Gabriel Tedros, and he's a homie, a brother in the struggle. He's a musician. He's a sci-fi writer. He's a part of a group called Copper Wire that's a sci-fi hip-hop Ethiopian space opera. He is fire, and he's joining us from, well, he's in Toronto, but he's joining us from Seattle. He's in Toronto for a week, and he's joining the Vibe Collective today to talk about music and resistance and love. And Octavia Butler, I'm sure, is going to come up. Hey. And blackness and a lot of different things. So what's good, Gabriel?
Thank you. That was an introduction. I'm also Earth, and I need water to be grounded.
Oh, all right. So how's Toronto? How are you finding it?
Toronto's great. I love Toronto. I come here about 2 or 3 times a year. To visit you.
So tell us a little bit about who you are. How'd you get into the music thing? How'd you get into music that's centered in community?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I never know how to answer that question, the long version or the short version.
Give us the long version. We got you for a minute.
I bet. So yeah, grew up, born in the 80s. My mom, she's from Ethiopia. She was one of the earliest Ethiopian migrants to that part of the country. When she came to Seattle, there was like 20 to 30 Ethiopian and Eritreans in Seattle, Washington. Now there's a huge community there now. And my father is Scottish, Irish, Native American. I grew up in a black, Mexican, Asian neighborhood. And for a lot of us, hip-hop was like a language that we used to communicate with each other in the neighborhood, to understand each other. because everyone spoke a different language inside their house. But when you came to school and when you went into the streets, into the neighborhood, you had to speak a common language to talk to each other. Also, I grew up feeling very isolated, like a lot of people do, no matter what your background is. And the voices in my headphones in the early 90s, particularly like voices in hip hop, were the only voices that made me feel like I wasn't alone and I wasn't crazy, because they told stories that I could relate to. I feel like, so I started making music basically around the time that Tupac died. I had a dream right before the night before Tupac died. And in my dream, there was like this big tunnel underground. It was like this subway, and you could get to this subway from my house. And at that time, there was no even concept of a subway in Seattle, right? So anyways, you go down to this tunnel, and there's windows in the tunnel, and all of the windows, there's this pure light just bleeding in through all the windows. And I understood this as, when you get on the train, there's no coming back. That's the train to the other side. And I knew that Tupac hadn't got on his train yet, because, you know, he had got shot, and there was 7 days after, 6 days after he got shot and before he actually passed away. So in my dream, I found Tupac, and I was like, yo, you have the ears and the attention of a whole nation of us. Like, you're supposed to be the one that's going to lead us to our liberation. And I found Pac, and I'm telling him all this stuff in my dream, and he's like holding my hand, and he just kind of shakes his head and he laughs and he says, it's on you now. And then I woke up and somebody burst into my room and said, yo, Tupac just died. And ever since then, I've had that in my head, like, it's on you now. Like, all your dreams of liberation, all the things that you want to see for the world, it's on you now. And that's when I started taking it seriously. I was 15 years old. And it's been the main thing that I've done ever since then. You know, it's hip hop, but it's also just independent storytelling and just telling the stories that you want to hear.
What's your journey been like in hip hop since you're 15? How has it shifted from that time when Tupac told you that it was on you to now, you know? But the dream world, alternate reality. And then now knowing the things that you know, the experiences that you've had, how has hip hop shifted your language, and how have you shifted the language of hip hop?
Yeah, well, hip hop has just completely changed itself. So it would be impossible to talk about that without talking about what's happened in hip hop since then. So, and I talk about this in the TED Talk that I did too, but in 96, the Telecommunications Act passed in the United States, which is a law that a lot of people don't know about. But before that, it was illegal for a corporation to own, basically to monopolize the radio market. And after that law passed, Clear Channel came about, and Clear Channel is a corporation that virtually owns every radio station on the FM dial, with the exception of college radio in Seattle and most of the urban markets. So so for like quote unquote urban radio, which is like what plays rap, since then you only get a very small, limited view of what blackness is in music, particularly like black masculinity. Like, what I love about Tupac is that you know, he was a true Gemini, in that he showed every side of his humanity, whether, you know, whether it contradicted itself or not. Like, in every moment he was fully himself. After 1996, I don't feel like we've really seen black artists like him in hip-hop in the mainstream, and I think it's by design because of the corporate control of hip-hop. So also, something that happened in 1997 is independent hip hop took off with Ruckus, Rhymesayers, Living Legends, Hieroglyphics, all these independent hip hop powerhouses that came up. And that's totally the school of hip hop that I came up in. It's a very do-it-yourself ethic. It's very much for myself, speaking for myself, because I can't speak for everyone in independent hip hop because it's so vast. But for myself, I've had the mentality of, let's focus on building the alternative and make that more appealing than the mainstream, because this mainstream rap BS that they're just force feeding on our kids is poisonous. It's murderous. It's an attack on our humanity. It's not just bad music. It's an attack on our humanity, you know? So I don't know. That's been my journey. It's been a journey of an independent hip hop artist. I started out with a live band called 500 Years. We were an artistic rebuttal to the last five centuries of colonization and oppression. And I said that at every show since I was like 17 to 21.
Rewind for a second. Yeah. Say that again.
500 Years, an artistic rebuttal to the last five centuries of colonization and oppression. We were a live band with like 10 MCs. I didn't have no facial hair. My voice hadn't changed yet. We had like tons of live songs and no studio experience whatsoever. And yeah, I put my first solo record out in 2001. It was called Sun Tour Recycle Soul. It was my first experiment with sci-fi hip hop. I wouldn't play it for you now. I wouldn't even play it for you now, and you're my friend. and then the next group that came about was Abyssinian Creole, which is me and my brother Kings, and it's a group that's still going strong to this day. And yeah, hip hop has taken me around the world several times. It's made my family ginormous and the world really small. It's helped me see that our struggles, like from Palestine to Ethiopia to South Africa to Mexico to just reservations to hoods all around the U.S., Canada, wherever, the symptoms of the problems might all look the same, but the root causes of it, the symptoms might all look different, but the root causes of it are the same in our ways of like fighting. We just have a lot to learn from each other, and there's stories and connections that I don't think I would have been able to make if it wasn't for hip hop. So it's, yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk for a minute, like, what was Tupac's influence on like growing up on the West Coast? You know, because there's a big deal about coasts and rap around that time.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I was someone who was kind of prejudiced. You know, I was kind of like, yo, I'm East, forget all that West Coast stuff. You know, it's the NWA a little bit back in the day.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until one of my friends put me on the Tupac that I realized that this guy was a genius, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if everybody who listened to East Coast or, you know, even listened to hip hop had that kind of divide, but I was wondering if you could really, it's not the same, like, either which way, and if you didn't, it's not the same, you can't really appreciate the influence if you're not out there. So I was wondering, like, if you could explain to a degree what his influence was like out on the West Coast and how it affected people.
In 1996, the year that Tupac passed, he was easily the most ubiquitous MC on the planet to us. If you lived in Seattle, or I would say anywhere on the West Coast, like, you couldn't walk outside without hearing a song from All Eyes on Me that year. Like, that album, it was everything. It was something that unified people, because a lot of people don't know, because Seattle is, like, I think by the census standards is the fifth whitest city in the United States of America. But we have three neighborhoods that are mostly people of color, and inside those three neighborhoods, gangs that have been at war with each other since I've been a little kid. So Tupac was a unifying factor. No matter what side you were from, no matter what gang you claimed, you loved Tupac. You know what I mean? And also, like, hip-hop back then, I feel like it's so polarized right now. Like, now it's like backpack rap is like a negative term. To a lot of people, conscious rap is a negative term. Mm-hmm. Back then, hip-hop was hip-hop. It didn't matter, like, this whole conscious gangster thing. Like, I really feel like that's some post-Tupac labeling and polarization that's, like, happened. Because, like, I grew up listening to as much E-40 as A Tribe Called Quest, as Mac Maul, as Boogie Down Productions, as Ice Cube, as Public Enemy, who they work together. Also Ice Cube and Public Enemy, and it was all one thing, you know what I mean? And it was really funny, is like, if you take certain NWA and Ice Cube songs and then put them next to Tribe Called Quest, like, if you've never heard them before, and ask, like, which one is the conscious rapper and which one is the gangster rapper, Tribe might sound more gangster and Ice Cube might sound more conscious, depending on what you're playing, you know what I mean? So it's like, those labels really don't mean anything, but I don't know, this is my opinion on it.
Where do you think, in terms of, so you're saying post-1996 is when you also really start to see the way that labels affected hip-hop. And the thing for me with Tupac that was super strong and connecting was his ties to the Black Power movement.
For sure.
With his mother being, dope fire, who held it down and held him down so that he could then do what he did. So talk to me a little bit about the connection for you between hip-hop and black identity.
Between hip-hop and black identity? Yo, I think, you know, I just posted this interview recently that Boots from the Coup did, and somebody asked him about, I think it was about how he got into hip-hop in the time period. And the way the interviewer posed the question was like, well, hip-hop was just like a few years old on the West Coast when you started. And he stopped the interview and he said, wait, I don't agree with this narrative that hip-hop started on a certain night in the South Bronx when somebody mixed the peanut butter and the honey and the chocolate. You know what I'm saying? Like, he made a joke of it, but then he went further to talk about how hip hop wasn't something that was alien from black culture when it first came about 40 years ago. You know, everyone's like, this week is like the 40th anniversary of Cool Herc doing the first block party in the South Bronx. But what Boots said, and I agree with it, and it makes so much sense, was when that happened, it wasn't like black folks everywhere were like, oh my God, there's this new thing, it's amazing. Like, it was so much like already a part of the culture. And there are people that have been rapping on tracks, black people rapping over drums in American music since the 50s and 60s. Like, hip hop is not a new thing. So I think it's a really interesting narrative that's been spun, that hip hop is a new thing that's only 40 years old, that anyone can get into, that separates it from the black experience. And I think it's dangerous, because the minute you do that, and the minute you put a label onto a cultural form and expression that is indigenous to a specific people's culture, need for spiritual survival, their struggle, it's like it becomes really easy to co-opt it, name it, label it, change the purpose of it, discard the people and take it from them. And I feel like that's what's happening with hip hop right now. It's happened with every form of black music in the United States, from blues to rock to, you know, jazz, and you know, we're there with hip hop right now. So I don't know, that's why it was a hard question to answer, because I feel like hip hop is just in being, it is black music, it is black culture, but it's being taken away. And I think it's important to hold on to the purpose of why hip hop is what it is, so it doesn't get taken away.
It's interesting. We cite like the 96 Telecommunication Act, mm-hmm. but like my experience of hip hop didn't have first experiences of hip hop. I didn't even really have a concept of record companies per se. It was like somebody gave you a mixtape, you know, or mm-hmm. people just doing graffiti or wherever yeah. else. Even the idea that rap becomes this representative of hip hop is beginning of that commercialization, because right. there's so many different aspects to
yeah.
to the culture. So when we say like, oh, it got took over by corporations, mm-hmm. the whole culture didn't. It was an aspect, like rap primarily.
Absolutely.
And then on top of that, it's like there's this element in rap, and in, I guess you can even say black culture to a degree, where you want to give your stuff, you want to make it quote unquote big.
Mm-hmm.
And hip hop always has this kind of aspirational bent to it, where it's like, yeah, we want to make it, we want to go worldwide, we want to have this mainstream thing, and we're going to use the existing structure to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what ends up happening is mm-hmm. it gets flipped, and then we say, oh, we've lost it. But there mm-hmm. seems to be something that's embedded in mm-hmm. this culture and other cultures that says, okay, well, this is the route we're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
But yet seeming to forget that there's always these kind of like pitfalls and mm-hmm. what have you that go along with that route. So I find that always kind of interesting, with the idea of when people say that, you know, hip-hop's gotten taken over, it's like hip-hop kind of gave itself up in it to a degree.
Yeah.
You know?
True.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that Gabe and I were talking about the other day when we were talking about celebrity culture.
Yeah.
And you've made a conscious decision to be independent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that decision. Where did it come from? How has it rooted you? And how mm-hmm. does it affect the way that you move now as Gabriel, but mm-hmm. also as an artist, as an educator, as a writer?
Yeah. I think the decision came from, before I even knew I was going to do hip-hop the way I'm doing it, it was artists like Goody Mob, like in 1996 and 97, who, I remember this one particular song they had on the Soul Assassins compilation called Decisions, Decisions, and Goody Mob basically, like, broke down the whole ills of the music industry and how they felt like they had no control, and they were, like, my favorite rap group that year in terms of content, and I was like, wow, there's got to be a way around this, you know? Far Side talked about it too, about not having control. Like, every time I step to the microphone, I put my soul on 12-inch reels that I don't even own. Like, that, those thoughts were embedded in my brain because of the rap I was listening to before I even took myself seriously as a rapper. So, I don't know. I was just really inspired by the mm-hmm. first independent hip hop artists that I saw come along. You know, which for me were. I mean, after Too Short was Mystic Journeyman, you know, who they did their stuff on 4 tracks, and a lot of the music sounded really dirty, but you could tell they were just like free and they could talk about anything they wanted to. And that's kind of why I wanted to make music, was because I wanted to have some place where I was completely free. with art and creativity. So that's why I made the choice to stay independent, because those were the only artists that seemed like they were free with their music, you know? Mm. So I'm sorry, was there a second part of the question?
Yeah, I asked, how do you feel like your decision to be an independent artist has affected your work and has moved you to the places that you are now, in terms of not just as a musical artist, but as an educator, as a facilitator, as a writer?
Yeah. Just that idea of not having any bounds or limitations or walls or borders on boundaries on the type of art that you do and the way you do your art, I feel like is, in a way, it's why I'm an educator and is why I'm thinking about and experimenting in different forms of storytelling in general. I have a very independent hip-hop ethic to anything I step to, whether it's writing a short story, whether it's coming up with a film idea, no matter what it is, like, it's rooted in the same way that I approach music, so, yeah. Which is make the thing that you hunger to hear, you know?
I had a question for you, since we're talking about, like, moving and inspiration. I feel like, for any artist anyway, when you strive to put your art out there and you want it to be a certain way, a particular way, and move people, I feel that it's important for you as an artist, it first has to move you. So I'm curious to know, because I listened to a particular song and I found it to be very inspirational. And so I wanted to know, like, what are some of the things that inspires you? What are some of the things that move you? What's your creative process like when you are creating these things in your storytelling?
Yeah. Thank you. What song was it that inspired you? I'm curious.
It's
maybe we should ask that off air.
Yeah. I can't remember the name. I'm so sorry. It's is it People Money? I watched the video today. It's just you by yourself, and you're in this area. I don't know where, but in the background is like this hill, and it's sort of like, do you know which video I'm talking about?
No Label or Mind Power?
Mind Power.
Oh,
that's
word.
The one.
Okay.
Very, very, very inspirational and uplifting.
Thank you very much. That means a lot to me. That song was inspired by cloudy days in Seattle. And not wanting and not wanting the weather to keep me inside the house all day. It's a very simple thing that the whole song came out of, and I wrote it in like 10 minutes. I feel like when I'm in my zone creatively, all I have to do is be quiet and listen, and the thing that is supposed to be written, I can listen to it, capture it, and write it down and record it. It took me years and years to get to that level, though, where I can just, when it's time to write, to just shut everything out and just do it. You know, it's very meditative for me. It's almost like the way I pray now. It's like, you know, yeah. I don't know how else to describe it. I do feel like when I'm at my best, though, it's like the song is working itself through me, and I'm listening to it, and I'm just trying to capture what I'm listening to. And by the time it's done, I don't even feel like I created it. And then those are the best songs to me.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Going back to something you said a little bit earlier, you said that in some ways hip hop makes you feel free.
Yeah.
Tell me about your visions for freedom.
Oh, I like this question. My visions for freedom.
For yourself, for your community.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah, that's a big question. That is huge and very simple. Like, to just be able to do what you love with no constrictions, and to be able to be with your loved ones with no boundaries between y'all either, you know? To not have to constantly worry about the systems of domination that separate us, to have access to clean air, clean water, food that isn't going to kill us, you know, all these things are tied up everyone's freedom is tied up with each other's. So, I don't know. The things that I want for myself, I want for every living organism on this planet, you know? Yeah, it's all that and more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Oh. Hey.
Hi.
Hi. So I guess maybe this is kind of wrapped up in maybe in the answers that you just gave, but mm-hmm. just thinking about the what you talked about in one of the things that you talked about in the TEDx talk about those of us or those who were within activist communities and having this constant adversary and how that translates to or doesn't translate into how to envision what life looks like mm-hmm. without capitalism or right. without patriarchy or mm-hmm. all the other isms that we talk about. Can you maybe recapture that for our listeners who maybe have not heard that talk and how mm-hmm. you came to that realization, how maybe your life was out of balance before you had that realization?
Yeah. Well, growing up, doing the work that I do and also just being a child of activists is a very common, familiar, everyday feeling to feel like your back's against the wall and you're fighting all these gigantic monsters, you know, the monsters that you just mentioned, these systems of domination, right? And when you're so involved in the fight that you're constantly fighting these several monsters that are coming at you from every angle, it's easy to feel like you're always going to be fighting. We feel like the fight is an inseparable part of our identity. But I believe and I've seen that nothing lasts forever, that you can win any fight. But if the fight has become so much a part of your identity that you let it define you, I've seen people and I've seen nations just completely recreate the same monsters they were always fighting, because without those monsters, who are they, right? So it's two people that helped change my mind and life, basically, and it's Waleed Amirish and Adrienne Marie Brown. They put together this anthology called Octavia's Brood, which is it's an anthology of science fiction stories from social justice movements. So it's a whole group of activists, organizers, artists, visionaries, people who in their everyday life work to make the world a better place, to actually engage with their creativity, to imagine what different worlds look like. And they had asked me to write a short story, and in their initial email, the way they asked for me to write the story and just the concept of it, it blew my mind. And like, ever since then, it's like, the way I work has been affected by that. You know, I try not to be so reactionary now, because things are always happening. We're always getting hit constantly, 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 constantly. But if we're always only responding to the things that are happening to us instead of putting our energy into the things that we want to build for the future, I feel like we only have so much energy. We burn ourselves out so quick, you know what I mean? So that's why I try to put my energy into things that restore me constantly, so I can do more and give more and be more for myself, for my community, for my family, for my dreams, for all of us, you know? So yeah, that's also how I got into science fiction. It was through the same thing.
We have to go to a very, very, very quick break. You are listening to The Vibe Collective on CIUT, CIUT.FM 89.5.
Become a part of CIUT 89.5 FM's history. Sponsor a Watt. Find out how at www.ciut.fm. CIUT 89.5 FM. The evolution continues.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
We are back. You are listening to The Vibe Collective. We're in a hot, hot conversation. I think that, yeah.
I have a follow up. There's always follow ups in conversations with you, but we went to go see Debbie's newest play. I feel like play is not even a word that can describe
workshop.
It.
It was like
a meeting of ancestral energy, but. One of the things that she said in the talk back that really struck me and that resonated with what you just talked about in terms of replicating the monsters that we're trying to fight, mm-hmm. is when she said, I realized how much of what I was trying to fight was living in my body, and yeah. I had a fundamental discomfort mm-hmm. with being in mm-hmm. my own body.
Yeah.
So I want to know from you, how do you deal with the discomfort that lives in your body from mm-hmm. the things that we're trying to resist on a daily, and how do you use music to work through that?
Yo, that's one of the biggest reasons I do music, you know, is to work that out. Like my friend Mark Gonzalez, he calls it healing in public. You know, I feel like that's what a lot of music and storytelling is. It's like we're working it out. It's like exorcism. Haile Gerima spoke to this recently in an interview I watched too. He was talking about how nobody in a colonial context comes into the world pure. Like no child comes into the world pure. You come in diseased with all these, you know, the things, and that's why we do art, is to work that, is to work it all out, you know. So I feel like it's a constant, it's like lifelong process, you know. So I don't know, just working it out, like all of us.
Yeah, and I say this all the time. I think that when you do perform as an artist and doing that sort of like exorcist, working it out, healing type work, mm-hmm. it's you're doing it for yourself, yes, but at the same time, it's also like opening up the space for other people to yeah. resonate and feel and make them feel safe to say, okay, you know what, this is what I'm dealing with. Let me be in my feelings.
Absolutely.
Like, let me deal with this as well.
Absolutely.
So I think that that work is particularly, it's imperative. I also find, though, when you do, as an artist, give so much of yourself
mm-hmm.
when you're performing and creating, it can be particularly draining, mm-hmm. especially when you are exercising certain
yeah.
demons and certain things. And it's like, it's important, I'm realizing now, to replenish yourself.
Absolutely.
So I want to know, how do you go about replenishing yourself, bringing your, I guess, your level up, your spiritual energy up, so that you can continue to do the work that you are doing?
Yeah. Self-care is a big piece of it. I have this, you know, I get asked to do a lot of shows.
Mm-hmm.
And like anyone, when you know you do music or poetry or whatever, and it has a particular political twist or substance that people can connect with, you get asked to do a lot of free things, and you get asked to do a lot of benefits, to the point where it gets really draining, because people want you to do that one thing that you do over and over and over again. And it's not to say that it's about getting paid, but they don't pay you either on top of it. So I don't know, when I get asked to do events now, I just listen to my body and I listen. It's like, body, does this feel like a yes? Like, am I ecstatic about doing this? And if my body says I'm not ecstatically, like, excited about doing this event, I say no. And no has been a very liberating breath. and also, like, just in building my sets, I often don't build sets until the day of the show. When I can, I don't build it. You know, when you have a live band, you kind of have to practice ahead of time. And when you're performing with people, your energy comes up because of the synergy of performing with people. But when it's just me and a DJ, I don't build my sets until I get to a place a lot of times. Because again, I listen to my body and say, okay, what songs feel good to do today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I try to build shows where like it starts high, kind of like takes you on a journey and ends on a really high note too. I think like beginnings and endings are the most important part of any shows, and yeah, you don't ever want to at the end of the show feel drained, because however you feel at the end of the show, the audience is going to feel the exact same way. You know, I want to shine a light. I want to create a space for people to feel, like you said, and to have important conversations and dialogue, but I also want to give them fire and energy to get up in the morning and to, you know, and hope and inspiration that like, yo, we're invincible, like we can do anything, we can, you know, like all of our dreams are possible. Like I want people to walk away from my shows with that feeling too. So
this is a teaching moment, like where? I'm taking notes.
Right on.
Yeah,
I'm glad.
I was wondered, one of the I guess, seminal moments for me in terms of, like, the idea of, like, this kind of, you know, the term, like, neoliberal has been around for, I guess, like, 40 years or whatever. But, like, for our generation, when it really kind of sunk in was the infamous, like, Seattle protests in 1999.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, that was one of the first, you know, while rappers were talking about, like, how much ice they got and mm-hmm. who they're going to do and what they're going to do, etc.
And who hit it first?
Shout out to Ray J.
No, never shout out to Ray J.
Creepiest Wait. Man alive. That's hard to do, man. Yo, like, you got to respect the accomplishment. Like, he's, like, I don't know, Ray J.
This is celebrity gossip portion.
This is celebrity gossip, yeah. Continued conversation.
It's because I just found out the other day that that fool put out a song called I Hit It First.
I didn't even know.
Yeah, you don't need to know.
I'm learning something new.
You don't need to know.
It's my learning moment.
It's a teachable moment. You probably don't want to listen to that song, but okay. You probably will because we talked about it.
No,
but
I probably won't. Actually. Okay. It's okay.
But it was like, while rap had this kind of focus elsewhere, you had, on TV anyway, you had primarily these kind of white kids, as it looked like, who were protesting this corporate beast that mm-hmm. rappers, in some sense, wanted to be a part of. I was wondering to what extent that's a misrepresentation and that there were people in Seattle or wherever else who mm-hmm. were also protesting this kind of like the rise of this particular corporate behemoth.
Well, I was there in the infamous Battle of Seattle, as it's been dubbed. And this is I'm laughing because somebody else yesterday referred to it as, you know, they said it in quotations, but like, you know, the birth of activism. It's like, whoa. You know, people talked about it like that. I was there. I was 18 years old. 500 years was active. That was probably our most active year. And we were very much, I felt like, a token hip-hop band. Like, we were everywhere that year, that summer. It was my first interview that I ever had on a camera was in the Showdown in Seattle.
Yo, you were so indignant in that interview, too. He's young. This is before his voice had changed.
Oh, yeah. And like all that. No facial hair. Like, I was confused as to why they were even had a camera in my face. Like, I had no idea how big of a deal it was back then.
You held it down, though.
But just to dispel a lot of myths, like, yes, there were people of color that were organizing in Seattle around the WTO protests. Yes, there were people of color that showed up. Yes, there were rappers in the middle of it, you know, from Company of Prophets, my group. Michael Franti was walking around barefoot in the middle of that protest. It was hilarious. But yeah, it was crazy. Like, they really shut down downtown Seattle. I remember, like, walking, you know, in the middle of the street on like day two or three and just looking in every single direction. And it was just a sea of people in every direction that had just completely shut the city down. And there was nothing, I don't know, never experienced anything like that. I don't know the answer to your question, but I was there.
Well, inside.
I wanted to, because you mentioned Octavia's Brew earlier, and can you just talk about how Afrofuturism has motivated you in your work,
mm-hmm.
And where do you see it going for your work going forward?
Yeah, I think it'll always be a part of my work at this point. So when they asked me to write a short story for Octavia's Brood, writing a story was very hard, but making music was really easy. So I got on a song with my cousin Macleet Hedero and my homeboy Elias, who goes by Burnt Face, and we were just making a song because, you know, we love each other and it's what we do. And I was in their city. They live in the Bay Area. I live in Seattle. And we could have made a song about anything, but I had this Octavia's Brood thing in my head, and I said, yo, I want to write a song from the perspective of somebody that's half human, half alien, and never been to Earth before. At this point, I hadn't been to Ethiopia. I'm mixed, so the metaphor was like very just concrete for me. And it was a great song. It was a song called Phone Home. We went to Ethiopia a few months later and actually shot a video for it on a castle in Gondar. And then we got signed, and then we made an album based on that, basically that same storyline. And it was just such a fun project. It's like, I don't know, after I did that album, I went back and listened to Sun to Recycle Soul, which is the first solo record that I made that I won't play for Luan.
I'm trying to get him to play it for me, but he won't.
I'll play you that song tonight, though. And yeah, I realized it was a throwback. Like, all of Copper Wire, the whole concept was a throwback to something I did on my first record that I kind of abandoned, you know? And yeah, and it's, I don't know, it's just such a fun thing to do, to mix sci-fi and hip-hop. I love it so much. You can talk about issues and have people relate to it in ways that they wouldn't relate to it. When you start talking about aliens, they're like, you know, they distance themselves from it, and then all of a sudden, boom, you hit them in their face, and it becomes personal and real, and they realize, oh, you're talking about me, you know? So I think it'll always be there. Yeah.
And it's amazing how quickly it becomes reality. I remember in the TED Talk, you're talking, for example, about Star Trek.
Yeah.
And how somebody looking at that says, you know, let's create cell phones kind of out of that, like having that idea of wireless communication to an extent.
Exactly. Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura on the original Star Trek, NASA hired her, and she went and recruited like almost every black astronaut that works for NASA right now, including the person that runs NASA.
Well, word up. Okay.
Black people putting real people in space. Bow. Well,
speaking about that, it's like I saw on TV, which I don't watch frequently, but yeah. I was someplace and held hostage and the TV was on. So
don't you hate when that happens?
Didn't shut my eyes. And it was they had a Mars colony. They're saying, okay, well, you know what? They're going to apparently make a reality TV show out of this about people preparing to go to Mars in 2023 and just go.
I wish you in Radio Land could see my face right now. I'm shocked.
You know, so you're going to train for 7 years, and then we're going to, if you're lucky enough, we're going to give you a one-way ticket to Mars, because humans are planning, we've done so well on Earth that we're planning to go ahead. to go colonize other places, right? And so, like, this idea of, like, how the imaginary becomes reality and vice versa, and there's this all kind of conversation. That's part of the reason why I think speculative fiction and social imagination is so important.
And putting our voices in it. You can imagine, like, if people that think colonization is A-OK and Christopher Columbus discovered America, if those people that believe that are the only people writing science fiction,
But that's Star Trek.
We're in trouble.
You know, like, Star Trek's, you know... Captain Kirk is like kind of like Christopher Columbus, like, you know.
Yeah, I was never really into Kirk, but Deep Space Nine, Deep Space Nine is like the greatest television show that ever existed. This is my opinion, but you had a black captain who was raising a single. He was a single man raising a black son, and they had a healthy relationship, and that never existed in mainstream media anywhere else before. I love Deep Space Nine. There was episodes of Deep Space Nine that made me just tears still to this day, based on that relationship between the father and son, you know. It's amazing. Watch Deep Space Nine as an adult. It'll blow your mind. I won't advertise any more television shows, I promise.
Go ahead. It's okay. You're fully part of the celebrity pop culture aspect of the show. So
celebrity gossip. I'm celebrity gossip.
Celebrity gossip. It just happens.
You know?
And LeVar Burton is my hero.
And?
Actually. Got that from Toronto.
LeVar Burton?
No, actually.
Oh, actually. Yeah, we've been talking lately about, like, Toronto-isms. And so the other day, me and Gabe were walking, and he looked at me and said something. And he was like, yo, man, like, there's enough love. And I was like, yo, what's good? Toronto's coming out of Gabe.
So you didn't say give them the differently and, like,
yo
bros.
I did. I gave that, though. I gave that.
Actually, do you know about differently? Because it's...
Yeah, I heard about differently.
Yeah, just use that.
Still.
Still.
Yes.
Still.
Still. Bro,
I gotta give it up to Toronto. You guys have a lot of like unique culture and slang. Not every city in Canada has that.
Not naming names.
You just pissed off Montreal and everybody else who hates Toronto.
I love Montreal. I'm talking about Vancouver.
What's good, West Coast?
Hi, 604.
The Vibe Collective loves the West Coast too.
Yes, I didn't play any Mocha Only this week. No.
That's my cousin.
Word up.
Speaking of, so Mocha Only, and you've done hella collaborations with a variety of artists from different backgrounds and different musical genres. So talk to me a little bit about collaborations. You mentioned Abyssinian Creole. Talk to us about that. Talk to us about Air to a Bird, Copper Wire. You kind of briefly mentioned it, but...
I hardly do any music alone. Like, most music that I do is collaborative. There's a lot of groups. I guess I'll start with the most recent and move backwards. Mm-hmm. Copper Wire is a hip-hop group, but also a transmedia storytelling project. So we did the album, Earthbound. but we also have science fiction short stories that have been written that are telling a part of the same story. Nnedi Okorafor wrote the introduction to it. There's a suite of video games that's coming out. John Jennings, who is this incredible comic book artist that did this anthology that people should check out called Black Comics. He's working on some comic book art for us that are telling a different side of the story. So it's a really exciting project. And it involves collaboration in many different mediums and not just hip hop. So that's probably the project I'm the most excited about in forms of collaboration. Abyssinian Creole is me and my brother Khalil, as he goes now, who's actually signed to a Canadian label, Wandering Works, and he just put out an album called Between Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. I'm featured on a song on there called Year 3000. We're always working on stuff. We've got a new album, mostly recorded. We don't know when it's going to come out. I have a solo record that I did with a producer in D.C. named Airmy. That's going to be coming out this year. Air to a Bird is a... it's a project that I did with my brother Amos Miller, who produced the Love Work record, and he's on vocals on the Air to a Bird thing. We just sampled birds.
Mm. No Label is my favorite song and from that album.
And No Label is produced by Mocha Only, Vancouver, BC.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, what inspired you to do an album, around, like, I see that literature and, like, storytelling factors into it, to your work. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to do one by... bell hooks, or to be inspired by bell hooks?
She just changed my life. I couldn't read bell hooks and not be inspired and not have it in my music. Love Work was the record that bell hooks really inspired. But she's inspired so much in my life that I feel like if you listen to my lyrics close enough and you read her, you'll hear bell hooks in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. But just the idea that love is a verb, that love is an action, that love is, how does she define it? God, it's been so long since I read it.
Which one? Bell Hooks and her definition of love?
Yeah.
She talks about it, yeah, like love is an action, and that it's a fundamental concern with your growth and the other person's spiritual growth.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she's talking, I think she takes it from Eric Fromm.
The Road Less Traveled. Mm-hmm. Is where, yeah. And also, like, if you really love somebody, you'll do work to undo every system of domination that stops people from loving. And that was, like, one of the biggest inspirations behind Love Work and why I even put the two words together as one word, Love Work, was largely inspired by her. Also, Khalil Gibran, who said the similar thing in The Prophet, work is love made visible. Mm. And, I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, I think so.
Sometimes I go off on these tangents. Hi, Radioland.
If I could just, I know that you had mentioned earlier black masculinity. Mm-hmm. I just wanted you to maybe extend, because I love talking about love and writing about love and hearing about love. If you want to talk more, maybe expand on what it is for you to, I guess, in hip-hop, mm-hmm. black masculinity and love. Mm-hmm. If you can just expand more, just talk about it more.
Where do we start? I feel like black masculinity in most forms of hip-hop is a very limited thing. You don't, especially in mainstream hip-hop, you just, like, black men just get to be these hardcore images that are not true to anyone I know, that I don't even think are true to any human being on planet Earth, the way black men are allowed to present themselves in the mainstream. And it's just not what I'm about. Like I said earlier, I feel like it's an attack on our humanity. So, in life though, I hate to say this, but there's not a lot of men that I look up to. There's not a lot of black men that I look, that I see and I'm like, yo, that's how I want to treat my wife. That's how I want to treat my daughters. You know what I mean? That's how I want to treat myself. Because I feel like we were talking about this yesterday, how people pathologize. How did you say it? People, go ahead.
Oh, is this when we were talking about the... So
we were talking about mental health and how
often it's the victim that gets pathologized, right, and not the perpetrator.
And I feel like in patriarchy... and in racism and in any system where there's somebody that has an inherited entitlement, something that they didn't earn, but that gives them a place of status above somebody else. There's something dehumanizing that happens there too, that also that never gets pathologized, but it is sick, you know. The way men a lot of times feel like, yo, I deserve this place of, you know, inheritance above women. It's sick, and it separates us from our sensuality. It separates us from our ability to truly feel. And I don't think it's natural. I don't think it has anything to do with masculinity as much as it does an inherited role, entitlement, you know? So, one of my biggest things that I'm trying to do with my life is to really redefine what black masculinity means for me and what means for men that, you know, that I work with, that I'm struggling with, that look up to me, maybe, like, all of that, you know? How can you be completely vulnerable and have that not seen as a weakness, because it's not? How can you allow yourself to cry as easily as you can laugh? You can't laugh, because both emotions are something that just happened to you. It's not, I think as humans, we got it twisted when we judge our emotions. You know, I truly feel like emotions are something that are not of you. They happen to you and through you for a reason. What you do with it is the only thing you can control. But particularly, like, as men, when we're told, you know, you don't get to cry or whatever, it's like it eats away at you. And men that tie themselves to that old school, really patriarchal idea of masculinity, I feel like the more you hold on to it, the less human you become, you know, because you're not allowing everything to breathe. So I try to be as vulnerable and as open as I can every day, and kinder every day, you know, and struggle every day, you know. I don't know, just I'm figuring it out, you know.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm trying. Thank you.
So you said that, go ahead, Kemba.
I just wanted to know if you could think about Adrian, I want to know if you could think about, after Luam asked her question, if you could share something with our listeners, some of your art.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You mean to spit something live, you mean?
It doesn't have to be live. I mean, it doesn't have to be like a freestyle, but just share some of your work.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. Do it first. My question is a follow-up anyway, so it's all good.
All right. What do you guys want me to rap about? I do this at shows sometimes too.
You want us to just give you a word?
I don't want to freestyle.
Okay, you don't have to freestyle.
I mean, I could, but yeah, what word?
No, just spit something from Colored People's Time Machine.
Ah, she asked for something old.
Right, or from your new mixtape.
All right. This is inspired by Idle No More. Is there a beat playing right now? All right, cool, thanks. Decolonize, unplug from the matrix, open eyes. We will not survive if we do not unify. 99% of all species are extinct. Humanity has been here but a blink. We call ourselves intelligent, but if you really think, we're the only organism I've seen with such greed, racing to annihilation at warp speed. Everyone's a passenger, no one wants to lead. We all feel alone, divisive group think. We bleed to a rhythm in flocks like birds, and walk in these herds uncertain but circling around each other with 7 billion puzzles pieces undercover. If we don't come together, we gon' die together. You could blame the weather, but really we did that. Frack for oil, make gas for tar sands, poison the water for our sons and daughters. Look, if it's really in dollars you trust, there is no tomorrow for us. We all gon' recycle back to stardust. We all gon' recycle back to stardust. Said if 7 billion bodies just die, do we become one again when our spirits rise? Or is division really only in our minds? I think humans are mostly blind. Said if 7 billion bodies just die, do we become one again when our spirits rise? Or is division really only in our minds? Humans are mostly blind.
Wow.
Drop, drop, drop. Amazing. Thank you.
Word.
So talk to us a little bit about upcoming projects. What can people look out for? Where are you going to be in the next few months?
Yeah. I'll be in Montreal next week, kicking it with these guys called Calmunity Vibe Collective. I'll be there on Tuesday, making stuff up. And, Children of the Dragon is the name of my next solo record. It's coming out independently, God willing, before the end of the year. And yeah, that's it. Octavia's Brood comes out on Octavia Butler's birthday next year, and I have a short story in there. So This is my first piece of like published writing.
What's the short story about?
It's historical speculative fiction looking at the life of Lalibela in Ethiopia, and it reimagines him as a time traveler, and it reimagines the monolithic churches in Lalibela as a spaceport.
So you mentioned like upcoming projects and places. Mm-hmm. Do you want to maybe shout out or throw out like where people can contact you? I don't know if you're on Facebook, Twitter, anything like that, a site, just so our listeners can reach out and drop you a line if they want to.
Yeah, I'm anti-Facebook, even though I'm on there. I'm anti, so hit me up on Twitter instead. It's just Gabriel Teodros. I have a website, which is a blog where I post everything that inspires me, and it's GabrielTeodros.com. That's GabrielTeodros.com. Thanks, y'all.
You good?
I'm good.
Yeah, I didn't want to cut you off, so that's why.
Nah, I'm good.
Amazing. So thank you for coming on, chatting with us, and spending time and sharing your energy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just checked Facebook and got an update, and one of the listeners said that whoever is being interviewed right now, referring to you, is absolutely amazing. Mind is blown.
Thank you.
So
look at that.
Thanks. Live update.
Thanks, listener. Thanks, listener on Facebook.
Jen Recknagel. I'm gonna shout Jen out. So that was like 2 minutes ago.
What up, Jen? From 2 minutes ago.
So maybe let's end it with just like three basic questions. I want you to answer off the top of your head.
Okay.
I be, I like, dead that.
I be chilling, drinking too much coffee. Mm-hmm. Second one.
Dead that.
That's the third one.
It's okay. I'm going to switch it. I want to end it on a I like that. Yeah. I was like, so dead that.
Silence.
Like that.
Love.
All right.
Yeah.
Fire. So tonight, before we move into the music that moves you hour, we got music coming up for another hour between 4 to 5.
Dope.
A couple of things going on tonight. Warsan Shear is in town. She's in Toronto. She's going to be doing a poetry show tonight. There's also an event around ending policing violence in Toronto. I'll be there. I'm emceeing it. It's an event that's being put on by a variety of different groups, the Black Lawyers Association, Network for Pan-African Solidarity, being some of the groups that are involved, going to be talking about the recent police violence that has been happening in Toronto, conversations that have been sparked by the killing of Sammy Yatin, by the execution, actually, by the Toronto Police Department. And there's going to be working groups that are going to be happening to end the night so that we can figure out how to move forward from here and how to make our community safer. It's a conversation about what protection is and what makes you feel safe, what makes us feel safe, what makes our communities feel safe.
And also one of the ideas I saw coming out of that kind of that conversation or that the pre-conversation is, do police really need to have guns? Like, do we need all of them carrying guns all the time? You know, and that's something to consider because we do have police forces that aren't perpetually armed.
Yeah, exactly.
And so how that might change the nature of police work and hopefully improve the safety of people, because mm-hmm. a lot of people get shot by police or bullied by police.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people get straight up executed by police, particularly young Black men, Black women, Black communities. So it's an important dialogue, and it's one entry point into having these conversations and making sure that we are, like you said before, Gabe, a part of the solution, that we write ourselves into these stories.
Mm-hmm. And write ourselves into the future.
All right. So again, thank you so much, Gabriel Teodros, for joining us today.
Thank you, Luan Kadani.
Make sure you're checking out his stuff on his website, on Twitter, and look up for his new album, Children of the Dragon, that's coming out in a few months.
Thanks, Vibe Collective.
Nice. Hi, everyone. This is Ralph Ben-Murgi, and I have a new show here on CIUT. It's called The New Sabbath Project, and we'd love you to join us for conversations about all things related to culture, citizenship, community, spirituality, and religion. the new Sabbath Project here on CIUT 89.5, Sundays at 2 p.m.
Urbane Cyclist specializes in urban active transportation. Check out our custom bikes built in-house, from fixies to touring and comfortable commuters, as well as great brands like
CIUT 89.5 FM needs a new transmitter, and you can help by sponsoring a Watt. Go to www.ciut.fm to find out how. CIUT 89.5 FM, the evolution continues.
Yeah, we can do it, guys!
One, two, three, four, get it!
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.